Hey everyone, Ashley Easter here, and I just wanted to let you know that the episode you're about to listen to has been adapted from the live videos that we had for the 30 Days of Courage in October 2022. So if things sound a bit different from our normal Courage Conversation episodes, you'll know why. We were 100% live when we created these for you. Hey everyone, and welcome to the 30 Days of Courage. I'm your host, Ashley Easter. I am the founder and executive director of Courage 365, and we have such an exciting show planned for tonight. We are going to be talking with Dr. Deborah Warner. She is a forensic psychologist, and she specializes in male survivor trauma. So it's going to be really powerful. This is going to be a conversation that I know is going to impact so many people. It's going to be informative. It's going to be supportive for male survivors. And we're really going to get a good education in this topic that's often not discussed. So I'm really excited about that. If you are just joining us for the first time and you are maybe tuning in to join the 30 Days of Courage and you've not participated in any of the other talks or anything like that, we want to welcome you. We want to welcome the people who've been here every single talk during the month of October. And we're actually in the middle of a big event, our biggest event of the year. We're having these conversations on Friday nights, and then we're having discussions in the Facebook group during the week. We have support groups on the weekends, and we're also doing some self-care challenges during the week. So without further ado, let me invite Dr. Deborah Warner onto the show. Hey, Dr. Deborah, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Hey, I am doing so good, and I am just super excited. Like I said before the talk, I try to ask sort of like some pre-questions to see what people are interested in discussing, and we got the most responses out of any speaker so far about this conversation, so like I know people are ready and raring to go.
Great.
Awesome. Well, the first question I want to ask is something that I actually asked you on the phone the first time, and that is just, what is a forensic psychologist? What does that mean? What do you do?
So forensic psychology merges the law and it merges psychology. And you make sense of that for the legal system, right? Mm-hmm. So they will ask you a question that you can answer. You get to tell someone's story through the eyes of psychology for the jury to understand and for basically for the law to be able to work within it. Now, people always think courts, everybody watched the Johnny Depp trial, right? You saw the forensic psychologist on there. And it could be a lot of different things.
Okay,
so if you could have an autistic person and they have a thing about stealing mail, well, now it's a forensic issue, isn't it? Because they've committed a crime, and now they're also in treatment for what's going on since they stopped the behavioral issue. That would be more of a forensic psychologist. See that? Even though you're doing behavioral training, you can also consult with other people. So forensic psychology is just a emergence of that. People have seen Dr. Wong on Law & Order Special Victims Unit, if you've seen that show. What he does is he helps categorize crime, or helps people understand what type of crime it is. It's not CSI. That's scraping under the nails. And I would never do that, so no. But no, it is really working with people.
Got it. That's really helpful. And it seems like it would be a job that really is super important, because juries often don't understand different mental health challenges, different trauma challenges that people have. And so am I understanding correctly that it's like your job to assess the individual and then kind of communicate it in a way that the judge and the jury can understand psychological issues or psychological divergency? Is that kind of correct?
Yeah, it's correct. Sometimes I'm called in to evaluate someone because they may be having a workplace issue, right? But the problem is they're threatening other people. Or they came in and they did something that made people uncomfortable, or they could be violent towards people, right? So I could come in and I evaluate that. I could get called in to do insanity, you know, and figure out at the time of that offense, were they insane? One of the things that I work on now is that I decide and help the Department of Parole decided someone should be released who has a violent offense and a mental health issue, because if the two are happening at the time of that offense, are they going to repeat and do that? So my job is to go in and figure that out and explain that to the court and paint a picture. And a lot of times I get to paint the picture of the client in a different way where they're like, oh man, maybe that's why they did that. Versus, yeah, he did this, he should be thrown away. No, he shouldn't. Right? Because there could be all of these other factors. So I try to tell someone's story as if, or I may not testify. I have to be able for them to understand what I was thinking and feeling and see and hear that client at the same time through written documentation.
That makes sense. Okay. That's really helpful. And again, that just sounds like a really valuable job and just giving people insight. Okay, cool. So I also know that your specialty is in working with male survivors and that you've done a TEDx talk on male trauma. And so I'm wondering if you could share with us some of the biggest myths about men and boys being victims of abuse or survivors of abuse.
The biggest myth is that boys aren't abused, right? People believe that men cannot be abused because of our social norming, right? And they tell men all the time, suck it up, be a man, right? And they say to men that you can't cry and you have to be strong. And you go back to the basics, men are the hunters, women are the gatherers, right? Mm. So men have to be masculine and bring the food and women gather, right? Even though that's gender norming, right? Mm-hmm. That's not exactly true in some cultures, right?
Right.
But that is how we westernize people a lot, definitely socialize men. So if a man discloses, people think it's not true or that didn't happen. And if it's a female perpetrator and a male survivor, a lot of times people say, well, he got it early, or, you know, pat him on the back. And you're over sexualizing a young boy to where if something's truly happening, he's not going to tell you because you didn't believe him when he first told you. When he first told you there was a problem, right? So that's one of the biggest myths about male survivors.
Mm, that's huge. And I have seen that so much. And I know that there have been times in my life when I've believed myths like that. Mm-hmm. And it's only been through education that I've started to kind of understand it. Is it how many, like compared to female survivors, how many male survivors, victims of abuse, would you say are statistically out there?
One in six. So think about six men you know, one of them this has happened to. But if you add in other types of abuse, that's just sexual abuse, right? You add in other types of abuse, it's probably one in four, right? Because that, I mean, trauma is physical, emotional, sexual, right? You can have all different types of trauma that affect someone, right? And men experience that in the same way as women do. It's just that it's looked at differently. It's viewed differently in our society. So imagine you have, I mean, just pick up six friends and you're like, it's right there.
Yeah.
That is really, wow.
Right. And it seems to me because of some of those things that you talked about, and we'll get into like stigmas and differences and those types of things, but it seems like it would be a crime that would maybe be underreported. Because of some of those stigmas. Is that accurate?
44% of men take 20 years to report. And I once knew someone who was in his 70s and he never told anyone. Or they don't even know that it's abuse. So imagine the behaviors that go with not reporting that you gain from being a survivor, right? Some people get very promiscuous. Some people do not. Some people don't have relationships. Some people have relationship issues, emotional regulation. Like imagine that's going on and you're 70 years old. Now you have to change how you've been doing things, but you're flooded with all of these memories and all this stuff you're dealing with. I mean, can you imagine how different someone's life would be if it was just believed in our society, if it was just believed when it was first told, to where they didn't think they had to take it in, or they didn't have the shame, they didn't have the guilt that I should have fought them off, or I should have done something, or I'm a boy and she's a girl, or all of these thoughts that come into someone's mind, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things I do when I work with male survivors, especially if they were abused and they were a lot younger, I take out these two little pencils and I say, you know, those pencils that are flathead and they're really small. Mm-hmm. And I take out a regular size one. I said, this was you then, this is you now. Mm. See the difference? How could you have done anything?
Yeah. That's really powerful. And I know even from my experience as a female survivor, there were some things that happened to me. And when I was talking to my therapist, she put in perspective of like, you know, that's kindergarten age. And, you know, sometimes we tend to think of ourselves in our adult bodies and we forget that like, oh, wow, that was just so small and so young. Yeah. And so that I love that you kind of have that example there. So you already kind of touched on it a little bit, but I want to talk about like some differences between male and female survivors, some of the stigmas, those types of things. So what are the specific ways male survivors deal with abuse that differ from how females deal with abuse? And how does that affect how we treat male survivors?
So men can have one emotion that is acceptable, right? And you're smiling. Anger, right? They can be angry. They can be assertive. But if there are any of the other emotions, people say all of these things about them, that you're being too soft, that, you know, all of these things, right? And, you know, it's interesting because men will act out. They will throw things. They will hit something and then they move on, where women want to talk it out and all these things. But men will also be more reckless in their behaviors, right? And a man on the football field beating people up, people don't think anything of it. But what if he's trying to hurt himself because he's having pain inside? What if he's hang gliding or jumping off buildings, right? Because he's having pain inside. People don't see those things. They don't realize those things. They just, because society accepts those things, right? Here's another example of women are more diagnosed with PTSD than men. Right. And why is that? Because women will talk.
Yeah.
Women will say something's wrong. Men do not do that because they're told not to talk about their feelings. Right. They're told to keep it in. They're told to be the star athlete, the entrepreneur, to be this person that is what society feels is masculine. Look at Superman. What does Superman look like? The most masculine thing you can think of, right? Every time we have a superhero, they always look that way somehow, right?
Yeah.
And so it's hard for men to be able to say that that happened and that they feel like it's their fault.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And I'm just thinking about it's just so sad that we put people in these boxes, that men are like this and women are like this, and that we socialize them in these ways, because there are some men who would really like to talk about it, but they're not allowed to, or they're not given space to. And then there are some men who don't feel like they can talk about it, again, because they were socialized that way. And so they shut down and respond in other ways. And just how our healing modalities, a lot of them have been directed towards our culture's idea of what feminine women, femme type of people would heal in that way. And we need those modalities, but to not understand men and boys and the way we socialize men and boys and incorporating that into the resources, it's just so tragic. And kind of on those notes, I'd like to maybe talk a little bit about some of the patriarchal beliefs and men needing to be strong, and they're told not to cry, always having to be the dominant ones about male, you know, there's just, I've seen this idea that like, you couldn't have been a victim because men can only be dominant in relationships. Like that's the only way it exists. And so maybe could you talk about how patriarchy sort of comes to play and kind of not only hurts women, but hurts men too?
Well, our society is built on men, right? Being in charge, and unfortunately, right? And it should be more equal. It should be a gender neutral place to be.
Yeah.
But it starts at the young age of, say you have a little kid and he breaks his car, right? And you tell him, suck it up. It's just a car. That's where it starts. Let him cry about losing his car. Let him be upset about it. Let him show the feelings. But the fact that you stifle him means that you've already told him you have to shut down. But yet the girl next to him, her Barbie's broken and she can cry and like, oh, sweetie, that's not okay. Whole different response. It starts with those responses. It starts with creating something gender neutral. Like instead of saying boys shouldn't hit girls, how about nobody should hit nobody? right?
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly.
Like, why would anyone hit anybody? And so, you know, it starts with that, you know, and we have Me Too and Men Too. And, you know, someone was talking to me, Miss Nichols, today, and she said, what about People Too? Why can't we just look at everybody uniquely with their own sets of, you know, abilities and hurts and pains, you know, yeah. and move forward. And so if we would stop putting labels on things, and as people are little babies and growing up, and we allow them to have normal emotions, we allow them to experience things as they want to experience it, that is what's going to make a difference. You know, and that will stop a lot of this. Well, it has to be, you know, a man who does this. It has to be a woman who does this. No, how about we all can do it? Like, you know, we all can work together.
Absolutely. And I already see some great questions coming in. I just want to let everybody know who's watching, please keep those questions coming. And at the end, I'm going to scroll back through and go back and get those. So we'll finish out the interview portion, but don't stop your questions. As they come up, drop them in the comments, and I will be sure to bring those up in a few minutes. Okay, so next question I've got here is, what would you say to the common trope that male survivors regularly grow up to be abusers themselves?
People, there's a myth out there. It's called the vampire myth, right? So that means once you're bitten, you're going to bite, right? Okay, that is not true. No more than if you fly a plane, you're going to become a pilot.
Right.
Okay. Do you see how absurd
yes,
that is, right?
That's so good.
And the reason people say this is because, you know, they're afraid of that happening. But most male survivors, because of the pain that they've gone through, will not do that to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And people who are pedophiles or people who are abusers were already abusers, okay, regardless of that. So that would have been who they were regardless of that. Now, is there nature and nurture? I know some people are going to say that to me. Yeah, you can learn things from people who are around you, but you still have to have a personality trait that causes you to go down that path, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't just go down that path. There's a lot that goes into it. So no, just because you were abused does not mean you're going to abuse someone else. Everybody has choices. Everybody can make a different choice. Now, if you can have pre-intervention to stop some of these behaviors because of environmental things that are around them, they have a better chance of making another choice.
Absolutely. That is, I think, the best I've ever heard that put before. And I hope people listening, especially male survivors tuning in, feel just a weight off that, like, you know, this is true. Yeah. That's not who I am. And that people who are just listening, who maybe aren't male survivors, will drop that terminology out of their language because it's not useful. It's not helpful and actually can be very harmful. So thank you for that. Next question is, how can we start to address these unhelpful stereotypes in our homes, in religion, and in the greater society? So we've learned some of these unhelpful things, but like, what can we do about it?
Yeah, talking like we're talking now, right? And being open to hearing a different point of view, right? That is one of the things. Taking in other people's cultures and realizing that is their culture and being able to work within the culture and being able to accept their culture. Part of the reason things happen, stereotypes and all of that, is because people want to be ethnocentric. They want to believe who they are is the only way. Right. And there's this book called American Cultural Patterns. It talks about ethnocentricity and westernized cultures and how there's a one way vision. Right.
Yes.
And it doesn't have to be. If people begin to become educated and begin to go out and listen and bring in all of these other things into their worldview, they'll begin to see the world differently because everybody has a different worldview. So let's look at other people's worldview and take that in. That's true diversity. Is accepting someone else's worldview.
Yes. Yes. I 100% agree with that. And that's something at Courage 365 we're really passionate about, is having a variety of voices from the survivor community, from the advocacy community, share wisdom, because if we just all stay in our own little bubble, not only is that hurtful to people around us, but that's hurtful to ourselves. Like when we're not growing and learning and stretching beyond, you know, we're really cutting off a great knowledge and understanding, and then we're not going to be able to serve people as well as they deserve to be served. So thank you for that. Reporting. Let's talk about reporting now. So how can we create a safer world where men and boys can feel more comfortable sharing their stories, where they're going to be more likely to be believed and respected when they report abuse? And I guess there's maybe two angles of this. One is maybe the interpersonal angle of like, how can families and communities be more supportive? But then I'm also kind of thinking about law enforcement. I mean, I think there's stereotypes that a lot of law enforcement carry about male survivors. So what can we do in that situation?
Well, there's two ways to answer the question. And first, I'm going to talk about when someone discloses to you what you're going to do, you know, and one of the things I do is people see me when I'm walking around the prison or when I'm walking with clients, I have this coat, has big pockets. I have nuts, a water bottle in it, right? Nice. Because I have a problem talking, right? I love to talk. But one thing, when a male survivor discloses, especially if it's for the first time, you need to shut up.
Yeah.
Because if you don't listen to that and have them feel heard, they're never going to tell anybody again. They're going to be the guy who's 70, like telling someone for the first time. Okay. So the first thing is shut up and listen. Okay. The next thing is to say, don't say, that didn't happen, or I know how you feel. You do not know how they feel. The thing you should say is, I'm sorry that that happened to you, or I'm sorry you went through that. Then the last thing you can do is say, thank you. Thank you for telling me your story, because they didn't have to choose you. That's a gift that they're trying to connect with you, that they're trying to have that intimacy with you, right? And if you take that away by laughing or not believing or not acting, that is what's going to change. And then you can say, what would you like me to do for you? That would be a great thing to ask, right? Especially if it's a child, if it's, you know, or if you're an adult, say, you know, if you're a mandated reporter, act, protect, right? That is what you need to do, right? And then law enforcement. One of the things that, because we talked about the myths that people have about male survivors, they're going to abuse again. Well, a lot of that comes from faulty prison research. People don't realize that. So early studies, now they've gotten better, but were researching people in prisons who were sex offenders or perpetrators of abuse, right? And asking them if they were abused. But the problem is that population's already arrested. So of course it's going to spike because you have a population that's already arrested for it. See, that's faulty research. Wow. You need to get everyone.
I had no idea that was where that started, but sadly that makes sense that they pulled it from.
Who are already incarcerated. So you're going to have the incarceration. Of course you offended. You were convicted. You were, it makes no sense.
Wow. Yeah. So I guess with police, it's, you know, making them aware of the statistics and maybe getting some training on those things, because it seems like a lot of us need training, but especially those who are doing the incarcerating,
up. I have a wonderful person, Captain Ann Young. She works with me at the Listen and You Love University, and she created online courses for officers and people to go and talk about these things, because, you know, it's the stigma that we have to stop doing, and we have to be able to, you know, work with people, but work with people with the right knowledge, you know, and so that we have the right goals for what we're doing. And when we're arresting somebody and we're not seeing it in the same way. And I will say, because I do a lot of work with the LAPD, they try very hard, and officers have a lot on their mind, right? But they are very, very open, you know, to learning new things, which is an awesome thing that I've experienced.
I'm really glad to hear that. That's good. And that it also gives me comfort to know you have a relationship with the LAPD, because they have so much they could learn from you. I know that's for certain. Okay. So What are some of the barriers to meaningful help for male survivors, and how can we create better support systems for them individually? I'm thinking maybe around, in your TED talk, you said something about, like, we have all these resources for female and women survivors, but where do we have for men and boys? And so, what are just some of the barriers, and, you know, how can we change that?
There's not a lot that exists. And if it does exist, it's a fraction of what the female programs get. And I am not saying that females should not have this and female programs should not have that. Please do not hear that.
What?
But what I'm saying is it should be equal. That's where that gender neutral comes in. It should be that they're the same resources for male survivors as there are for female survivors. And people will say, well, there's less of them. There's less of them because they don't believe they'll be believed. So there's no programs and people do not create them, right? And so that is something that should happen. There should be prevention programs, and it starts in the schools, right? Mm. And so that male survivors know that it exists. So if something happens to them, they know who to call. Why aren't we talking about 1 in 6? Why aren't we talking about men healing, that there's the weekends of recovery for male survivors? All schools should know about these people that exist, or RAIN, or, you know, and that's, you know, that's where we can begin. You begin small and you start changing the thinking in generations, right? You have to change the generations that come up, and then the generations are so used to hearing it that it changes how people perceive things. Nobody knew what the internet was, right? But you ask a young person to help you with the internet, oh, they know what to do, right? But you ask an older person, because they weren't exposed to it,
yeah,
they don't know. It's the same concept.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think you're right about changing the minds of young people. And I do have a lot of hope for Gen Z and younger, just seeing the advocacy work that they're doing and the way that they are showing up. And just, I was reading a news article, I guess it was maybe last month or something, and it was about these teen boys who noticed a teacher being abusive to some of the students, and they started keeping track of it just among themselves as teen boys. And eventually they were able to take their documentation and something was done about it. And so I do feel a lot of hope for the younger generations, but my heart also breaks for the older generations, because, like you said, it takes so long for people in the older generations to talk about, especially male survivors. And that's just, I don't know, just so heartbreaking. So heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking, but that's how you make the change, you know, and you have to first realize, accept that it's there, right? And then you have to act, and then you have to follow through with the action, and then you have to wait. That's the part so hard for people. They think, well, I did it, I followed through, I created the program, why hasn't it changed? You have to wait. Time is what's going to tell you. And when things start to change, it's because time, because people have begun to look at the prevention programs and look at the change and look at the numbers go down, right? And the waiting is so hard for people. But that is what will tell you if something is making a difference.
That's really, really good. I want things to happen so fast, and there are a lot of things that happen fast in our, you know, internet world, but you're right. Like, it does take time for things to sink in. And do you feel hope that there's progress? Do you feel like you can see some change happening?
Absolutely. There's absolutely hope. And you know, because you don't know what has affected somebody, right? You don't know what little spark that you have grown in somebody that creates a moment of change, or creates something to where they do something a little bit differently, you know? And sometimes you get those nuggets at clinicians. Sometimes you get people who come back. And, you know, I remember someone said that they heard my TED talk, and they said, from your TED talk, I realized I needed to shut up and I need to listen. And I was like, oh my God. But see, that just gave that one survivor something. Right. And so you never know. So, yeah, I have hope, because it takes those one-on-one micro interactions to create big macro ones where the whole world is involved in that. So you have to do the one-on-ones like we're doing now, and it's being broadcast. Right. So that's what's going to make the change. So is there hope? There has to be. There has to be hope.
that makes me feel a lot better, because sometimes day in and day out of advocacy work, it's like, is anything actually changing, you know? And so that is something that I need. And I feel like a lot of people listening can maybe relate to that too. Before we kind of get into the Q&A, I want to talk about some fears that people sometimes have around male survivors and survivors in general, really. But one is, like, how common are false reports of sexual abuse? I've had this question come up, and yeah, I want you to address that.
You know, in my experience, most people don't lie about that, right? And if there is, if it does seem, let me put in different words, if it does seem that someone is lying or something's being falsified, people don't realize that when you're traumatized, your brain does not take in the information, right, in a linear fashion, right? So you're going to have memories, because your body's trying to protect you, that memories that are not in an order, and it seems like you're being inconsistent, you know, and you're not trying to be, your body's just trying to protect you. And eventually, sometimes years, right? Kids will also name the wrong abuser because they're categorizing things, or they're scared to say who it is, or they get things mixed up. That happens a lot. It doesn't mean they're lying. It just means that their body couldn't handle what's going on. But people who have lied, or it has become that something's going on, one, there's another pathology there, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times people who have delusions or schizophrenia sometimes, but there's a pattern of that person being mentally ill. That's a different thing, right? And that goes into a category of schizophrenia, which is a certain percentage of the population, than someone who's been sexually abused and is, you know, a survivor. And so, you know, you have to tease out, well, is this mental illness or is this this? And not every survivor has mental illness. Not every person who has mental illness is going to claim an accusation, right? So you have to really look at the history and listen to someone when they're talking to you, you know?
Right. I think that's a really clear distinction, because just because you have mental illness doesn't mean you're going to lie about something. Mm-hmm. And just because you're a survivor doesn't necessarily mean you will have mental illness. That's really good. Right. And I had read a report by, I think it was the FBI that put it out, and said something like only between 1 and 8 reports of sexual abuse are unfounded. And unfounded doesn't mean untrue. It just means something that they couldn't, you know, reasonably verify. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it really is a small segment of the population. Mm-hmm. And even the reason somebody might lie about it, like, I've seen where, you know, there are situations that maybe it's parents that push things because they're in a religious community and they don't want, you know, mm-hmm. it to look like their child was promiscuous or, you know, something like mm-hmm. that. It's mm-hmm. very rarely the survivors.
Right. That's where the other variables come in, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, look at the R. Kelly case, right? Yeah. And they had a videotape. The prince or the basketball coach said that it was the girl. And she's like, it was not me. And her parents are like, it's not her. And they're probably trying to preserve her future. They're mm-hmm. probably trying to keep her from having to have pain and all of that. But her story's not told. Also, then more people are exposed to being abused because of that, right? And it's very hard as a survivor to come out and say that and to do that, because you have so many other things coming at you and so many other parts of your own history that might prevent you from talking or might have you recant your story. It doesn't mean you lied. You just, there's a lot of variables there, right? Okay. And so it's very hard. And I always commend a survivor for telling their story because of the difficulty that it brings.
100%. And so kind of going off of this question, we received a question along the lines of, you know, what's the difference between someone who is abused and someone who is an abuser? Like, what are some signs that you could look for?
Yeah, so that's a really a hot question. But someone who's abused, it's not really, I can't give you a catch-all of how they're going to behave, right? But you know someone who is probably in an abusive situation because you know their history, you know that this keeps happening, or there's a pattern, with certain people, and those people always are doing the same behavior. So that goes with the abuser, right? An abuser who's saying, oh, you know, I didn't do that. But then there's several people who come and tell the same story, like Bill Cosby, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying, I don't know. I'm just saying it's several people. There's a pattern that right. is coming out, right? And so you look for patterns in people. Okay. You look for patterns in how they treat other people. You look for how they speak to people, how they interact in the world. You can usually tell someone who's an abusive person. It doesn't even have to be sexual abuse. It could be just emotional abuse. It could be physical abuse. But those patterns are there. Someone who is being abused will probably retreat, don't want you to have anything, you know, will keep a distance to you, right? Because they don't want people to know what's going on. They're embarrassed. They're ashamed. And then when you finally break through, you see the fear in their eyes. There's mm-hmm. something called the hollow, like, especially in male survivors, when they're just dead, you have the dead yeah. eyes. That's a giveaway to me a lot of times. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, somehow I got to break through. So that pain is, you can tell, right? Mm-hmm. But their pattern is always, there's nothing else connecting them, you know, to the world, because they've kept so many secrets. Mm-hmm. So those are some things you can look at.
That's really helpful. And in addition to that, I think that our audience should know, like, you are a professional. You are mm-hmm. somebody who has studied this for years. And it's actually part of your job to be able to kind of understand these scenarios. But the general population right. is not a therapist. So no. I would say, and I want to hear if you agree with me, like, when in doubt, trust and give them resources that they need. Because mm-hmm. you're not, like, you know, the general population is not an investigator. They're not the police. They're not a psychologist. They're not yeah. a therapist. And to try to take that role, probably not gonna do very well.
Well, and also, if trust, give resources. And once you hear their whole story, just be there.
Yeah.
You know, what can I do for you? Or if you're a mandated reporter, report.
Exactly. Right?
The one thing that I see with kids and teenagers is that nobody did anything, right? And that's what shuts people down. But if they're a child and you're a mandated reporter, do your job. Don't say, well, I know that family really well and we'll just go have a talk with them. No, no, no. The more you can tell, the better.
That's really, really good. And I want to remind everybody to keep dropping your questions. We're about to go to the live Q&A portion. So if you've got anything else, I'm going to be scrolling back through, drop them in there. I see you all commenting. But what are some resources that you would recommend for male survivors? I know you've got some, and yeah. I just want to hear, like, what can we do to support the male survivor community?
Well, 1 in 6 is great. Men Healing does a week in a recovery for men, and it is so amazing that they can tell their story and they get help, they get therapeutic help, and they get to work with men who are just like them and have this weekend, and it's changed lives, right? I myself have written a book called His History, Her Story, and it's about the spouses of being with a survivor of sexual trauma. But it also talks about all types of abuse. It talks about the vampire myth, talks about cultural considerations. It talks about to stay or leave and what this means for you and your life. And and if that, you can read that book. And if you also can take my online course at the Listen and Love University on that topic, because it is something that is rarely talked about. So you'll hear me talk about my story from my point of view. And then my husband talks about what happened to him and how it affected our marriage or in our lives. And then you have professionals taking pieces of the story and tearing it apart to show you what this looks like therapeutically. It's very fascinating.
Wow, that's really, really good. Yeah. Well, we definitely will want to drop those links in the comments and under the video. We'll make a note to do that afterwards. And I'm really excited for people to check that out. Let's get into some of the live questions. Is there anything you wanted to say before we jump into live questions? Anything that I left out that you just want to share?
No, and okay, any of those cool. things I talked about. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, awesome, awesome. All right, so we've got a bunch coming through. Okay, All right. One person says, I would love to know her take on the role of homophobia and the fear of being called gay perverts some boys from or prevents some boys from reporting. I had a survivor tell me this is why he never reported. Have you seen a lot of this? So homophobia, being called gay for experiencing abuse.
Yes, I have seen a lot of that. And especially if penetration has happened from male to male, it's even harder for men to say something. But, you know, it's that stigma in our society. Just because mm-hmm. you were abused and you were abused by a male does not make you gay.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You had an experience that has changed your life. Mm-hmm. And you have before your life, and you have when the trauma occurred, and you have after the trauma. And you're going to be living with after the trauma for the rest of your life. Mm. And so the problem is that people mix up that they, you know, oh, well, that means that you were gay. That happened to you. No, no, no. It means that you had an experience. You had your life before, you had an experience, and you have your life after the trauma. That doesn't change that if you weren't gay before, you're not going to be gay now. Even if you act out because of what happened to you, doesn't mean you're gay. It means you're trying to figure it out. You know, and so that's the difference. And the one thing people don't understand also is that they say, well, I had an erection or I had an orgasm. Yeah, you might have. All it meant was that your parts worked. They worked the way they were supposed to. Has nothing to do with anything else, but they worked. It doesn't mean you wanted it. It doesn't mean anything. It just means that they worked.
Yeah, that's, I think that's really important to know because, particularly with male anatomy being so visible and outward facing, for lack of a better term.
It's right there.
Yeah, like that's just how your body responds when there is sensation, and that doesn't mean that you wanted it. Yeah, that's really, really good. Yep. Got another question here. It says, my son told me when he recalled it, I'm assuming that means abuse. Mm-hmm. He told me everything. He lied and told me he didn't know him, but he actually does. How can I encourage him to disclose this to AG investigators I have already talked to? I'm not trying to push him. I think that's Attorney General investigators.
Okay. If you know who it is, you can tell them. He's a kid. He's a child. So if you're the parent and you know who it is, then you can tell them, because that way the abuse stops for others and for your son, right? Him lying is fear. Sometimes it is, you know, the grooming process, right? So they feel very close to the perpetrator. They don't want to get them in trouble. They may even say they love them, all of that. That's, and you don't know what messages in the grooming process this kid has heard. So they may lie and say it's someone else just because of that. But there's nothing wrong with you disclosing that.
Right, right. And I think this might be a follow-up to that question. It says, my son has come such a long way. I think it would be cathartic to get it out. I think the story getting out. Do you agree with that? And it seems like...
Again, I don't...
Yeah, depends.
It depends. I don't know the age. Now, if the son is 50 versus 6, that's a whole other thing, right? Mm-hmm. Then he has to tell his story. If he's 50 years old, you can't go tell a story for him, right? But if he's 6... Absolutely. There's nothing wrong with you naming, because the kid will, it's a protection issue, right? Yeah. It's you protecting your child. So it really does depend on a lot of variables. The age, definitely.
Right, right, for sure. This question is, do boys get blamed like girls do for sexual abuse? Many girls are told they seduce the abusers.
I've heard that too. It depends. The blame is different. The blame is I couldn't fight him off. I wasn't stronger, you know, and also, you know, they get the blame in different ways and they get it in the same way. Right. So you have to really look at what the context of the abuse was. But the answer is yes, they do get it. Women, you just hear it differently. Right. So you get all of these things saying that, you know, you dressed provocatively, you did all these things. But I will tell you, pedophiles will say that about a boy. And they'll say, well, you looked at me, or, you know, it's like, what? I'm a kid. I'm 7. I'm not going to look at you. Right. But you hear the same thing. So it depends on the context.
That, I think that's really helpful. Have you done work with clergy sexual abuse?
It depends on how you look at it. Not like with like the Catholic priest, but I have had some clients that have been abused from clergy. Yes.
Got it. Yeah. Do you notice any differences in like religious based trauma and just kind of like general population trauma?
It depends on the type of religion and the type mm-hmm. of trauma, like the ritual abuse.
Yeah.
The ones that have the ritual abuse, I have seen some really severe cases of mental health issues, like the mm-hmm. dissociative identity disorder, things yeah. like that, because of the rituals, because it can be so intrusive, you right. know, that happens. Not that other sexual abuse isn't, but I'm trying not to be graphic here.
Sure.
I've just seen some major psychological problems,
yeah.
problems mm-hmm. from religious abuse that is a little bit different than other abuse.
That makes sense. I have a couple of other questions that people sent in earlier. And so anybody who's tuning in, feel free to keep dropping your questions. And if I happen to miss your questions live, feel free to, you know, re-ask the question, but I'm going to go from my paper now, from pre-asked questions. And this is, can you please discuss the use of incorrect terms some male victims use after experiencing rape? Like, I lost my virginity, I succumbed to temptation, I became impure, especially when raised in purity culture.
I was going to say that sounds like purity culture language.
Yes.
It's very religiously based, because a lot of that language comes from me having a religious base versus someone, I want to use the word secular, but I'm not trying to offend anybody. I just don't have another terminology.
Sure.
But that come, you know, I hear that a lot within a religious based culture versus a non-religious based culture. Mm. And so, you know, and that's from the shame and the guilt of having sex, period. Right. And then it's forced on you. You could do nothing about it, but you feel like you should have, and you feel like you're wrong and you're bad, right? There's a theme that I've seen in a lot of male survivors is that they're dirty and bad, right? Right. They did something wrong, you know, and it's like, no, this was forced upon you, right? But then you add the religion, and then you add the purity and the marriage and the marriage bed, it changes how it comes out.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. And purity culture, just whether it's for yeah. men or for women, it's just bad. Yeah. It just hurts everybody. Yeah. And wow, let's just teach people about consent and sexual health and all of those things yeah. and not get into all these right. purity rules. They just, yeah. Not good for anyone.
It adds a layer that's a little different. Yeah.
100%. It's popular to say trauma informed in a therapist's list of specialties. But how can you identify a qualified therapist for male survivors?
Ooh, that's a loaded question. I one of the things that I always tell people is to therapist shop. It's like, it's really shopping. So your first consultation is usually free or at a lower cost. See a couple of people, see if there's a good fit. It all depends on how you feel, right? And, you know, ask them questions like, how long you've been doing this? You know, what is your area of expertise? How are you trained? These are all questions that you should be asking any therapist, because there's some types of therapy modalities that may not work with you, and there's some that will. And, you know, and therapists are very open, you know, so I would ask those questions. I would shop. I would decide if I want a man or a woman or someone who doesn't identify. You can do that too. And I would figure out what's going to work best for me, right? You could be, I've been doing this 26 years, and you may have a better fit with someone who's been doing it 2 years for whatever reason is about you, right? Mm-hmm. So shop and find the right fit for you.
Yeah, that's so good. And I even for myself, I know sometimes it feels exhausting going into therapist's office. So I've sometimes just set up like calls and just like,
yep,
before I come in, I actually want to talk to you because you work for me. You know, you're yeah. here to help me. And so, you know, yeah. I want to make sure it's a good fit. But yeah. I think we need to normalize therapist shopping. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do a discovery call, 30 minutes, yeah. right? And if it's not a good fit, it's not personal to the therapist, trust me.
Right, Right.
And it's not. And a lot of times I'll give people referrals. I'll say, you know what? I know someone who's great for you. And I don't have a problem doing that. Right. Because it's not about me. It's about you. Therapy is about you. And you're paying for this. Get what you want.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Question. The effects of narcissistic parents long term. Do you have any thoughts on how parents who are narcissistic affect their children and maybe affect survivors, male survivors?
It's going to affect any child. And it's going to, you know, but imagine, I guess, I will look at the scenario, a narcissistic person and your son's been sexually abused and you tell them and you make it all about you. Imagine what that would do, right? I mean, oh my God. It's all about you. It's all about how you feel and how you're going to be viewed and how other people are going to see you and how they're hurting you by telling you and like all of those self-centered thoughts, right? That's going to shut someone down. And then you have all the other stuff that's probably in the relationship, right? So the long-term effects, I remember I told you time earlier, in time, that's going to get to you. That's going to weigh on you, okay? And so you have to think of the prolonged effect of how, what that's going to do, like what behaviors you're going to pick up. Are you going to be narcissistic? Are you going to pick up narcissistic behaviors? Are you going to use substance abuse to cope? Like, what is it that going to affect you?
Yeah. 100%. And I'm seeing comments about people who, are dealing with narcissistic parents, and it is really a difficult thing. I guess kind of off that question, this is some of my own wondering. I have seen a lot of people calling people narcissistic, particularly in social media. And is there a difference between somebody behaving in a narcissistic way and somebody having narcissistic personality disorder? And like, I know it's sort of almost like a trendy buzzword, narcissism. It's a real thing that needs to be taken seriously. Yeah. But I've also seen some people use it where they're just like, you know, every single person that I meet that, you know, we don't agree, they must be a narcissist. So like, do you have any thoughts about like diagnosing other people if they don't have a diagnosis and the spectrum?
Well, we shouldn't be diagnosing each other like that. You know, leave that to the professionals. I mean, there's a book called the DSM, you know, and now I think we're at the DSM-TR, a new one that came out, and it has criteria. Yeah. You have to meet the criteria to be a narcissist, and it's under the personality disorders, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you don't meet that criteria, you are not a narcissist. You might have traits, you might have symptoms, but everybody has a symptom of something.
Yeah.
Right? So us going around saying, hey, you're a narcissist. Well, do you really know that? Are you a professional? Like, you know, be careful because our words have power. And that's what I want people to get. You're calling people that, you're saying that, that's hurtful, especially if it's not true. Or maybe you don't understand the context of their behavior, but you're saying it's self-centered. There's something called the fundamental attribution error where people make a personal attribution when it's a situational one. You don't know the situation of why that person's behaving that way, but you're saying it's them, right? So don't do that. And, you know, tell them one of the things you can do is be proactive. I don't like when you did this. It makes me feel like this. And then see what they do. Do they change the behavior? Do they not change the behavior? But someone who's not going to change the behavior may not be someone who gets the graciousness of having you in their life. And that's okay. They're going to go on and live a life with or without you.
Yeah.
You don't have to say, well, you're a narcissist and blah, blah, blah. Look at the behavior. Tell someone, be assertive, and then see what happens.
Yeah. I think a big thread that I'm picking up in this whole conversation is you talk a lot about patterns. So whether it's patterns that you see that somebody is a survivor, patterns that somebody is an abuser, patterns that somebody is a narcissist, or whether it's situational or kind of a lifelong trait, like I think patterns are so important. And I think again, kind of going back to that wanting answers quickly, our culture, you know, expecting solutions really fast. We often want to know, you know, for sure about something or someone really quickly. But really, a lot of it comes down to noticing patterns and patterns over time. And I think that is what has stood out to me really strongly in this conversation. So thank you for bringing that forward.
Yes, it's looking how people act, you know, and looking the patterns to their belief system. I mean, people tell you who they are.
Yeah.
People show you. Okay. So it's like, it's like fool me once, you know, that's on you. Fool me twice, that's on me. Right. Mm-hmm. Because people will show you. And once they show you, believe them.
Yeah.
Believe them and take care of yourself. There's nothing wrong with that. That's one thing we do in this culture, is that we try to hold on to things that may not be good for us. Right. And we try to keep secrets about things that may not be good for us.
Yeah.
So if we would just let go, and then let the universe take control, a lot of times life would be better.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Well, one last question for you is just to the male survivors listening, what would you say if you could just like speak into the camera right now? What would you just say if you're sitting across from them, something that you feel like male survivors need to hear?
I'm sorry you went through that. And one of the things I always say to people is to listen. Let's listen, let's love. Meaning that you don't just hear words. You listen, you take it in, and you respond with love. And if you respond with love, there's nothing that you can say that's really going to hurt someone, because it's coming from a good place. So when you respond to a male survivor, respond with love. So one of the things I would say is just, I'm always going to listen and love.
That's so beautiful. Yes. And right after this, we'll be sure to drop links in the comments to your resources. And I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. You have given us just a wealth of information. You've brought the conversation deeper. And I'm just so grateful to know you're in the world doing this work, helping so many people, educating so many people. It's just truly been an honor to speak with you tonight.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been an honor to be here.